From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. During the Gulf War, many Arab states rallied to help boot Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Then many Arabs rallied for Saddam, the defiant survivor. Now the neighborhood would like to see him gone, but hates to say so with Washington riding high. Tonight, On Point, Arab angst and dreams over war and Saddam. We begin with the UN Security Council face-off over Iraq. The United States, Great Britain, and Spain today introduced a new resolution that lays the final groundwork for war with Iraq. Colm Lynch is United Nations reporter for The Washington Post. I asked him how likely it is that a divided Security Council will pass the resolution.
Well, no one's saying anything. All the other council members sort of walked quietly into the council, refused to comment on it, so they need to have a look at it first. But it's a smart sort of tactical resolution in the sense that it's not quite as tough and hard-hitting as we had expected. There's no explicit threat of military action. There's no formal finding that Iraq is in material breach language that is it would provide legal justification for war. All it says is it's kind of simply states that Iraq has failed to fulfill its final opportunity to disarm. Those countries that are interested in participating with the Americans, they'll cite that as further legal cover for military action. And those countries who will be compelled or pressured to support it, small, poor countries on the council, can use that language to say, no, this doesn't authorize military force, and we all recognize that Iraq is still in violation, so how could we not support this resolution?
So if it's so fuzzy, Colm Lynch, if it were indeed to be passed, what could George Bush then say to characterize what the UN Security Council had done to justify war?
Well, he can say that he's given Iraq more than 3 months to voluntarily disarm. He's given them every chance, every opportunity, and he will say that they've blown it. I'll just mention that even though I think the language is quite cleverly drafted, there's nobody on the council who thinks that this resolution is about anything but war. So even though it doesn't have all of this sort of politically radioactive language, the explicit language about military force, it's still going to be seen by everybody as authorizing military action.
But if it's that vague, would it give Tony Blair, for example, the political cover that he appears to desperately need at home to go to war?
Absolutely. I spoke to some British diplomats this morning and asked them that question, and they said, yes, we would see this resolution as providing further legal authority. You have to remember that Britain's position is they don't need this resolution, but politically, you're quite right, it's essential. And so this would make it a lot easier for the British to come along. So that's why it's so important. But I expect to see a very stiff resistance. The French, the Germans, the Russians have already launched their own diplomatic counteroffensive. They have another series of ideas that they're circulating in the council as we speak, things about reinforcing inspections, increasing the numbers, setting a new series of deadlines that would extend out to the middle of summer for inspections to take place. So it's going to be very, very tough going over the next couple of weeks.
Colm, take us into the numbers game then. As I understand it, as of today, there were four countries lined up ready to support this resolution: the United States, the UK, Spain, and Bulgaria.
Right.
They need nine. Can you imagine the other five? Who might the candidates be?
The candidates are essentially everybody. Nobody expects two non-permanent members, countries that don't have veto power, to support the resolution. Germany and Syria are the two countries that are seen as they're absolutely going to vote against the resolution. They don't have veto power. They can't stop it. So now you have to go to the rest of the council member. There are three African countries, Cameroon, Guinea, Angola, very susceptible to economic pressure, both from the French side and from the United States side, but probably at the end of the day have more to suffer if they stand up to the Americans. So that pressure will be brought to bear. Chile has an important trade sort of issues that it's trying to work out with the United States. That could be jeopardized. The Americans have been signaling to the Mexicans that all sorts of issues that are important to them in concerning immigration and other areas, those might be held up by Congress if they don't go along with this. So those are some of the countries that really need to be brought on board. Pakistan, another one that will have a hard time politically supporting this resolution, but it's very close to the United States and may ultimately be brought along.
So that makes it look within the realm of possibility. If they can lean hard enough on three African countries, Chile and Mexico, they would have the nine votes. to pass it.
Yeah, it certainly is possible, but you don't want to underestimate the potential sort of opposition and resistance from countries like Mexico, who are very angry at the Americans, who feel that they've been bullied around, who have a tradition of standing up to the Americans.
Yes.
And so it's going to be very difficult politically for them back home to go along with this, but it still is very much a possibility.
And what about the veto threat? France, China could wield that.
China wouldn't.
Russia.
A few people who think they would. Russia, the real concern is France at the moment. France is hoping that if it was forced to cast a veto, it would do it along with the Russians, but there's no guarantee that the Russians would go along with them. France has never opposed, vetoed a U.S.-sponsored resolution since the 1950s. It's almost unimaginable, although their president, Jacques Chirac, has stiffened his position so much that it would be very hard for him politically back home to support any resolution. And they have hinted that they would veto, but Jacques Chirac, speaking in Berlin today, said that that France would oppose a resolution, but didn't say anything about a veto and didn't even really strongly hint that they would cast their veto. So, you know, it would help the Americans. Maybe they could get the 9 votes. Maybe countries like Russia, France, and China might be brought along to at least abstain, if not support the resolution. But that's also not the greatest outcomes. I mean, you would have the resolution adopted, but it wouldn't be sort of a unanimously adopted resolution that has the full force of the international community behind it. It would reflect a divided council, a divided international community, and it would not be a great way to go into a military operation in Iraq.
And finally, Colin, President Bush has said throughout and again today that it is the very relevance of the United Nations that's on the line here. Is that view shared by other Security Council members? Do they see the fate of the UN riding on this debate and outcome over the next few weeks?
They do see its sort of credibility on the line, but they see its credibility on the line in two various ways. One is that if the U.S. dictates to the Council what sorts of resolution, what sorts of actions it's likely to take, then it raises questions about its independence and credibility, which is also important. On the other hand, as you said, that President Bush has been issuing these warnings that the U.N. will go the way of the League of Nations and that it will become irrelevant and obsolete. And that's a real possibility. But successive U.S. administrations have kind of leveled these kind of threats against the United Nations in the past, and they always seem to find a new use for it. So even if they go around the Security Council, if they go outside the Security Council to launch a military action, there's still a possibility that countries that are opposing war now might join in you know, playing some sort of role in the reconstruction of Iraq, might want to sort of stay in the picture and might provide some support through the UN for sort of cleaning up the mess afterwards. So you'd be surprised how many new uses that countries can find for the Security Council, including the United States. So I don't know that it'll be completely wiped off the map if the U.S. is forced to go outside the Security Council.
Colin Lynch, always great talking to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Colin Lynch is United Nations reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier today from New York. The 22 members of the Arab League thought they had finally set a date for a summit meeting this weekend. Now it's off again. But even the run-up to a meeting exposed deep rifts among the Arab states about war with Iraq. Syria, Libya, and others want to avert a war. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan now see war as inevitable and are focused on planning for a post-Saddam era. But even in the second camp, there are rifts, fears, and terrible tensions. Saddam is no hero in the Mideast's halls of powers, but let the genie out of the bottle, and no one is sure what will follow in the region. If the Arab world wants Saddam Hussein gone but won't endorse a U.S. attack, what is the conclusion Washington should draw? What does it mean to go to war with Iraq without a broad Arab coalition on board? And how hard should Washington listen to those neighbors? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is John Vohl, professor of Islamic history at Georgetown University and associate director of the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown. Good evening and welcome, John Vohl.
Good evening. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Also with us tonight, Fawaz Jerjes, chair of the Department of Middle East and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College and author of America and Political Islam, Clash of Cultures or Clash of Interests. Good evening and welcome, Fawaz Jerjes.
Thank you.
It's good to have you again.
Thanks.
John Vohl, give us the big picture here first. Is there a regional attitude at this late hour? We've been told by Washington that if they push boldly ahead, the Middle East will come on board quietly or otherwise. Is it on board at all?
I think it depends on the level that you're looking at. In terms of general public opinion, in terms of the kind of mass support that might be hoped for. There is relative unanimity, but it's against a war with Iraq. Where you have the differences, I think, are differences that are part of the leadership, who some of whom simply have to, when push comes to shove, do what the United States says.
And at this point, so you're talking about heads of state lining up.
Arabia and Jordan, for example.
Saying, yes. Oh, we don't like it, but...
We don't like it, but if the United States really gets into it, then we have to come along. But a country like Syria, a country like Libya, doesn't really have that same kind of vested interest. And so that the questionables become then states in the Gulf. I mean, Kuwait has to go along. But some of the other Gulf states then again become questionables as to how much leverage we have under this particular circumstance.
Fawaz Sherjes, we read that just last week in Cairo, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, Prince Bandar, told other Arab leaders, look, this is going to happen. We'll be better off in the aftermath if we have not opposed it. We'll be in a position to influence the post-war shape of Iraq. Is that the Saudi message now, and where is it playing and where is it not?
Well, let me make one point very clear. This is one of the few wars against which there is unanimous Arab and Muslim opposition. That is, with the exception of Kuwait, no Arab state supports the American war, even though most of them would like to get rid of Saddam Hussein. But while the Arab states are unified in their opposition to war, they are divided over the most effective means to influence American policy toward Iraq. And here, at the risk of simplification, let me talk about two camps. I mean, you asked me about Saudi Arabia. Let me position or even contextualize the position of Saudi Arabia.
Good.
One camp, which is composed, as John said, of Syria, Sudan, Libya, and Lebanon, calls for a strong stand along the same lines as that of Germany and France in opposing the coming American war in Iraq, and calls on Arab states further to refrain from offering any assistance or facilities to any U.S. military operation. And thus, of course, we know that Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia offer assistance to the American, at least, coming war. This camp, even now as we talk, is still ambivalent about attending the Arab summit meeting in early March, unless the Arab states promise to take a decisive stand against the coming war and hold the United States responsible.
I suppose Sudan, Libya, Syria are not likely to be much consulted by the U.S. after a war, even if they were supportive.
Absolutely.
In advance.
And this would come to the second camp, another camp led by the key Arab states, particularly Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, is not willing to go down that particular road, the road of what I call the, Syria, Sudan, Libya, and Lebanon.
Opposition to war.
While this camp argues that war is dangerous and unnecessary, they hold Iraqi president responsible for the current crisis. They would like him to do more to avert war. And I think this pro-U.S. camp appears, as you said, and as John said, appears to have come to the conclusion that war is inevitable. And as such, I think it's trying to position itself to minimize the costs of war vis-a-vis domestic stability, of course, and the need to keep their strategic alliance with the United States. And I think the meeting of the Arab foreign ministers, as you know, in Cairo over the last few days, revealed deep cleavages. That is, the Arab states are not only divided about tactics, in fact, they were unable to agree on an agenda, let alone to set a date. I mean, I think the big point is the following. The Arab states find themselves in a terrible bind between Iraq, that is overwhelming pressure by Washington to join the American campaign, and of course a harder place, overwhelming anti-war sentiment on the part of their public. And I think the Arab states are trying to navigate in a very hard and dangerous terrain, and thus marginalizing themselves in the process, unfortunately.
John Vol, just 30 seconds before the break, does Washington have enough regional support to go to war?
It certainly has enough regional support in material terms. It's beginning, apparently, to get support from Turkey. It has support from Kuwait. We've got the forces on the ground. The question is, do we want also to have real support in policy terms?
And that you don't see at the moment.
I don't see that at the moment.
We're talking tonight about Iraq's neighbors on the eve of war in the Middle East at a big moment in the Arab world as U.S. troops gather. What does it mean to go to war with Iraq without a broad Arab coalition on board? And if the Arab world wants Saddam gone but won't endorse a U.S. attack, what conclusion should we draw? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq's neighbors on the eve of war, the Mideast, at a very big moment. My guests tonight are Professor John Vohl from Georgetown University. He's Associate Director of the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding there. And from the Middle East and International Affairs Department at Sarah Lawrence College, Professor Fawaz Jerjez. You can join the conversation as well. Will war create an Arab backlash or change or both? Why hasn't George W. Bush secured the Arab support that his father did? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Fawaz Jerjez in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia today at the Non-Aligned Movement. The vice president of Iraq spoke out bitterly against what he said was a lack of support from the Arab world for Iraq at this time of need, in his view. Was there ever a chance that the Arab world would stand up and forcefully join hands around Iraq and said, you cannot attack here?
Well, no, not at all. While, as I said, while there's a great deal of opposition to the American campaign against Iraq, I think also most of the Arab states, and in fact most of the Arab public, would like to see Saddam Hussein out of the picture. And I think here in this particular sense, while the Arab states have made it very clear, at least most of them, that they are against the war, I don't think they have articulated a clear-cut position with regard of what to do vis-a-vis Iraq. I think the big question is the following. I think, the big question is, what do the Arab states want? That is, what are the most effective means to influence the course of the events that will take place in the heartland of the Arab world and, of course, affect the destiny of the Arabs? Of course, we know that although the Arab states cannot determine if Washington goes to war or not, they can, in particular, they can influence the U.S. decision-making process by presenting concrete proposals that help the resolve the crisis. I think here it's not enough for the Arab states to say that they are against the coming war. They must be proactive and take concrete steps, as I mentioned, to empower the Iraqis to end their nightmare.
So if I ask then 2 points. First of all, if they want Saddam out, why don't they want this war? And secondly, and if you could look at Saudi Arabia in particular, what is their ideal? What would they like to transpire at this point?
Well, I think Saudi Arabia, of course, would like Saddam Hussein to be out of the picture, but, of course, without a major military campaign that, of course, will create social and political upheaval, not just in Iraq itself, but also throughout the region. I think what the royal family would like is what I call to keep the institutional apparatus in place. That is, the Sunni apparatus being in control of the future Iraq. I think Saudi Arabia, not just Saudi Arabia, of course, the key Arab states, are concerned about the potential repercussions of an American military campaign on the balance of power within Iraq itself. They are afraid that Iraq itself would fracture and descent into chaos, of course, subverting its enemies, in particular Kuwait, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, and, of course, empowering Turkey and the Iranians, since, of course, more than 55% of the Iraqi population are Shiites. And I think the royal family is concerned about, deepening and intensifying Iranian influence in Iraq itself. And they're also concerned about the aftershocks of the Iraqi earthquake on stability in the region itself. That is, to what extent will a U.S. military campaign affect the political stability of the existing pro-U.S. governments in the region, not to mention the repercussions on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
And Fawaz, just briefly, then, on the Saudi government in particular, are they most concerned post-war about the impact of chaos in Iraq or about Washington turning and saying, now we're ready to push democracy on across the region, including in the House of Saud?
Well, I think they're concerned about both. I think the hardliners within the Bush administration have made it very clear that, of course, Iraq is just, the second phase of the war against terrorism. And, of course, the ultimate objective is to install, quote-unquote, a democracy in Iraq and hopefully have spillover effect into the various authoritarian Arab states. But I think there are three major concerns of the key Arab states, particularly Saudi Arabia. The danger the basic fragmentation in Iraq itself, and Iraq would fracture and descend into chaos, potential repercussions on the stability, political stability in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, in Egypt, and in various Arab states, and of course the potential of escalating hostilities on the part of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
Fawaz Jirjes, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Fawaz Jirjes is author of America and Political Islam, Clash of Cultures or Clash of Interests. John Vole, I want to put the flip side of that question to you, I guess. If the United States goes into Iraq, as it looks as though it will do probably soon, and if it's victorious in a relatively short time, that amounts to a great demonstration of American power, which is, of course, Washington's dream outcome, will that bring the outliers into line? Will it bring the Syrias and the Libyas in tow, or will it create a greater backlash in the region?
I think that it's important to try and figure out what we mean by a really good victory.
I guess Washington thinks quick.
Yeah, quick, but quick and military. And I think that part of the mythology now that is associated with the planning is that the first U.S.-Iraq war, Desert Shield and Desert Storm, was quick and successful. But the problem with that is that that is a purely military judgment, a purely tactical judgment. Our high-tech military killed thousands and thousands of Iraqi soldiers and succeeded in forcing the withdrawal from Kuwait.
And because we didn't go into Iraq that time, we could then pack our bags and go home.
We could then pack our bags and go home, but not only could we then pack our bags and go home, but those people who see it that way then forget that what that, quote, victory did was it left a legacy of a real awareness of the United States as a belligerent superpower that would be willing to kill thousands of Muslims, thousands of Arabs, without any thought about the fact that it has done so. And so that while people proclaim the victory in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, there are other people who look at that Gulf War as being the beginning of the global war of terrorism of the 1990s.
So you're not buying the line that if Washington shows power, a demonstration of power, this will have the effect of shocking the region into, you know, acquiescence.
Absolute crushing military power did nothing to stop the first bombing of the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
It did nothing to stop the bombing of the USS Cole. It did nothing to stop the final destruction of the World Trade Center. And I think there are many people who might agree with me that, in fact, rather, that crushing, humiliating military victory, in fact, set in motion at least part of the context for that terrorist decade.
John Vole, stand by. We have on the line now from Tehran in Iran, Los Angeles Times correspondent Azadeh Moaveni. Good evening and welcome, Azadeh Moaveni.
Good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Can you give us a perspective from Iran at this late date as Washington continues to push toward war, Azadeh? What's the perspective there? How does Iran view this forward motion toward war?
Well, the Iranian government has assumed that war is inevitable for a long time, probably going back to the first State of the Union address when the axis of evil phrase was introduced. So at the government level, Iran is trying to figure out how it can maneuver itself to see its interests secured in the post-Saddam Hussein era through backing the Iraqi opposition, through making whatever diplomatic inroads it can, coordinating with Turkey. So at the government level, there's a sense of comfort because this is something that's been expected. The Iranians have been figuring out how they can get what they want out of it for a long time.
And what would they like out of it? What post-war situation would Tehran like to see emerge?
They would like to see a government, a representative Iraqi government, in which the Iraqi Shia have a fair and representative role. And given that Shia in Iraq are a majority, that's something that they feel the Iraqi opposition is on board with, too.
Just to clarify this is the Shia Muslim globally the minority, but in Iraq and Iran a majority, although Sunni Muslims run Iraq.
Exactly. You've had a situation, you know, under the Saddam Hussein regime where the religious minority is in charge. Now, Iran has traditionally been the major Shia power in the Middle East, and this has been source of discomfort for other Sunni regimes like Saudi Arabia.
But what does all this mean about the potential for a fractured Iraq? Would Iran go so far as to encourage Shiites in Iraq to break away from the central government to try and carve out separate states or autonomous regions?
Definitely not, because a fractured Iraq would also mean a separate state for the Kurds of northern Iraq. Iran has a Kurdish minority of its own, as does Turkey, and does not want to see any sort of instability in its own Kurdish region. It doesn't want to see its own Kurds thinking of breaking away. So the territorial integrity of Iraq is a major priority for Iran. So for Iran, the ideal scenario would be a territorially intact Iraq where the Shia have a role in government that is reflective of their majority in society.
Let me ask you this, Azadeh Moaveni. Does Tehran imagine that it may have greater sway over Baghdad after a war, or that Washington will have greater sway? Do they see Washington as having a long-term power there, or that being untenable?
In the long term, I think that would be unacceptable to Iran. And the Afghanistan experience has been a helpful sort of experiment for this exact same Iraqi situation, in that a short-term sort of American civilian government could be tolerated. But in the long term, if there was a sense, you know, a perception in Tehran that the United States was manipulating a post-Saddam Hussein Iraqi government that meant to represent American interests, for example, having a Sunni leader or a Shia leader that was handpicked because of his or her relations with the U.S. rather than someone that was popularly supported, that would be problematic for Iran.
Azadeh Moaveni, John Foles, stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. Benjamin's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Some comment, my own view on that.
Yes, please.
Is that this is going to be really the beginning of the end for all the totalitarian regimes in the area. That's why they're opposing the war right now. Iran, Syria, Saudi, Emirates will be under quite severe pressure after the war with their regimes, and I think they're afraid of that.
And who will the pressure come from, Benjamin, in your mind?
The facts in the field. People will be able to see that there is a possibility for democracy, and that will create a pressure from within.
Benjamin, thanks for your call. John Vohl, how about it? Do you see this war creating a situation, a kind of domino effect that brings down what our caller Benjamin calls, and many would, totalitarian regimes around Iraq?
Or at least authoritarian regimes.
Yes.
I think he's right on that. And I think that this is one of those dilemmas that U.S. policymakers have not yet clearly addressed. And that is, if we win the war, and if we, in fact, are absolutely successful in creating a democratic state, and if then we go further, as Benjamin suggested, and have a dynamic for creating democratic processes elsewhere, the United States has to recognize that by supporting democracy, we might, in fact, be supporting a regime change that would bring to power an anti-American regime. That is, if we are looking at an Arab world where the overwhelming majority of the population is opposed to the American war in Iraq, if they are opposed to American interests that have traditionally supported authoritarian rulers in their society, and then suddenly they have a chance to create a democratic regime, they are not suddenly going to become lovers of United States policy.
So they could be democratic, but not necessarily pro-American. I would think that in Tehran, this element might have particular resonance, Azadeh Moaveni. How are thinkers in Tehran looking at the fully express American desire to put democracy or something like it in Iraq? Is that seen as encouraging democracy in Iran, or as bolstering the hand of the clerical powers there?
Well, I don't think that anyone in Iran is really harboring under the illusion that what the United States intends to do in Iraq has to do with democracy per se. At the same time, I think that what does happen in Iraq will have tremendous implications for Iran domestically in two ways. I think that Iran, also being on the axis of evil, is going to be in a position of at least being number two. Thinkers and ordinary people alike wonder whether after Iraq will the United States turn to Iran. Even if that scenario doesn't play out, there is also the issue of having the United States surrounding Iran on two sides. There's a major U.S. presence in Afghanistan, and then there will be one in Iraq as well. That's going to put pressure on the Islamic regime here to mend a lot of the infighting that's basically deadlocked the country for the last 3 years. A hope of ordinary people, and I think people within the government, themselves, who are tired of having a great deal to fight about, but nothing externally to pressure them to actually come to some sort of consensus.
So it could create a united front in Iran, but no saying exactly where that united front would be. I want to welcome to our conversation now Morhof Juhasjadeh. He's a fellow at the Middle East Institute and adjunct professor of political science at George Washington University, joining us from Virginia tonight. Good evening and welcome, Morhof Juhasjadeh.
Good evening to you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Syria, take us to that border of Iraq. How is Syria has been vocally opposed to the war, yet they've been cooperative with the United States in the war on terror in efforts to track down al-Qaeda. How does Syria see its interests being affected by war?
Well, we have to input in what you said also the fact that the Iraqi regime has tried more often than not to destabilize the Syrian regime, mostly in the 1980s. So there's absolutely no love lost for Saddam Hussein or his regime. Having said that, Syria has a lot of fears of what looks like is going to come in by way of a U.S. assault against Iraq, and that is mainly the fragmentation of Iraq. A fragmentation of Iraq would have very negative, very dire consequences potentially for Syria, in that Syria has its own Kurdish minority to the tune of 11% of the population, and the potential establishment of an autonomous Kurdish entity in the north of Iraq might whet the nationalist aspirations of the Kurds in Syria. So Syria really has the very same fears as Turkey does. Now, the fragmentation of Iraq, of course, will not only mean a potential Kurdish autonomy in the north. It might, and you touched on that earlier, it might mean a separate entity of Shiites in the south. So here, we really have a very unstable situation that would be a consequence of this war destabilizing the Middle East further than it is already destabilized as a result of the Arab-Israeli conflict.
So is Syria most concerned then about its own internal stability that could be affected by an Iraq in disarray post-war?
It is concerned about its own internal stability, certainly with the Kurdish question. It is also very concerned should the United States, quote-unquote, occupy Iraq, manage it, administer it for the next year or so, as we have been recently reading, that Syria would be totally surrounded by American power. And in that case, Syria's leverage over Israel, the modicum leverage that it has over Israel, would be weakened even further. Syria would feel totally hemmed in.
We've got to take a short break. We're talking about Iraq's neighbors on the eve of war. What does it mean to go to war with Iraq without a broad Arab coalition on board? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq's neighbors on the eve of war, the Middle East at a very big moment. You can join the conversation. Will victory create support for the U.S. in the region, or fear of more U.S. intervention? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Nate's calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Nate. You're on the air.
Yeah, good evening, guys.
Good evening.
I just think that the people in the United States have got to recognize the extent to which Bush has completely failed in his mission to sell the merits of this case internationally. There's very, very, very little support for this in Europe and practically none in the Middle East. I think you're going to see regime change in Britain and possibly Jordan if those countries go ahead and support the United States to the extent that it seems they may. And I think that you really have got to look at the center of this administration, because George Bush is as inept as his father was adroit. Two examples of how he's completely bungled the opportunities to build support in the Middle East.
Go for it, Nick.
Inside Iran, at the time of the September 11th catastrophe, there was an enormous popular outpouring of affection and support for the United States of America, while the clerical power centers that control the secret police, the army, and the tools of oppression are anti-American. The president and large parts of the Majalis are, in fact, open to closer relations.
And your second example, Nate?
Well, by lumping Iran into the axis of evil, he killed that.
Yep.
You look at Turkey, the first elected government with an Islamic base is now in power. There's no support for the United States inside Turkey, and we are niggling over $6 billion. We are humiliating the first popular Islamically elected government over $6 billion.
And today that Turkish cabinet endorsed plans for U.S. troops there. Nate, we've got it. You're looking for regime change in London, perhaps before elsewhere. Thanks for your call. Let me put that all straight to Tehran, where the LA Times correspondent Azadeh Moveni joins us. I guess first of all, Azadeh Moveni, do you agree with Nate that there was a post 9/11 some kind of opportunity for a real warming? And more than that, I would ask, what does this likely war say to Iranians about America, about its impulses and its designs in the region?
I think Nate is absolutely right. I think that there was an unprecedented window of opportunity after September 11th for improvement in Iran-U.S. relations. And also, again, right into the beginning of the campaign in Afghanistan, Iran offered a great deal of tacit support, important support that facilitated the U.S. campaign and led it to being a great success, and was rewarded by being put on the axis of evil. And it was quite ironic in the sense that the Iranian population is the only significantly pro-American population in the entire region. It was the only country where you saw demonstrations and an active show of sympathy for September 11th. And the U.S. neglected both the importance of that in terms of having a major Middle Eastern country with a pro-American population, and also the overtures that the Iranian government displayed after September 11th and into the Afghanistan campaign. In terms of implications for Iran about sort of American intentions vis-a-vis Iran, I think that there's a great deal of frustration in Iran right now domestically about the state of the reform movement and the slow sort of move towards changing the Islamic Republic. I think that
they want more democracy reform. They're not getting it fast enough.
They want it fast, and they see the potential for the U.S. to go in now and change regimes in the Middle East. I think that there are enough Iranians who are frustrated enough that they actually hope that that could happen in Iran, too. And that's a frightening but interesting possibility.
Azadeh Moveni, you open our eyes there. I know it's a terrible hour in Tehran, and you've been very good for joining us. Thank you so much for being on tonight.
My pleasure.
Azadeh Moveni is Los Angeles Times correspondent in Tehran and former correspondent for Time magazine in Cairo. Victor's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Victor. You're on the air.
Hi there. Hi. My point is this. I'm amazed how we talk about democratizing the Middle East, because as I understand, I have read and I have heard, if there was elections in the Middle East, most of those countries would have elected Islamic republics, just like in, for example, Pakistan, in which they won big time, or Iran, or, for example, in Algeria, which the fundamentalists won the elections and the military junta decided not to give up power.
So, Victor, you think it's better to leave the Middle East with despots and monarchs?
Well, the despots and monarchs are our friends and allies. Mm-hmm. They have served our interests, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I don't really believe we're going there to be the good guys who are going to change the Middle East into a democracy like our style, because those people have their own culture, they have their own beliefs, and they were going to vote most likely in what they believe in, which is Islamic fundamentalist republics. And this is the worst nightmare for us. I really tend to believe that what we want to do is get there, put some bases in and be in control and keep everybody divided and confused. I don't mean to be cynical, but this is it. I think that's most of what we're trying to do is exactly that.
Victor, we've got it. Thank you for your call. John Vole, what about this whole idea of rolling democracy across the region? Pipe dream, something to it, something in between?
I think we have to be willing to define democracy in a way that is more broadly inclusive. And I think that if we follow what Victor is suggesting, the attitude that Victor is suggesting, that despots are our allies and elections will just simply bring enemies of the United States, then we are sure to identify democracy with anti-Americanism. But Islamic fundamentalists aren't the only ones who are interested in having a participation in democracy. And you have a wide mainstream of Muslims who are not pro-authoritarian, who do not like their despots, but who are also opposed to the rigid fundamentalism and sometimes the violent terrorism of the extremes. But these are also people who believe that Islam and democracy are compatible and can work together to create political systems in which humans have the right of participation and other human rights.
Mm. Morhof Joujadeh, let me put a version of the same question to you. Do you foresee a period of political turmoil following war in Iraq, if and when it comes, and it may come soon? And if so, can you imagine that turmoil unfolding in a positive way, or do you see it leading to a kind of negative consequence?
On the face of it, it looks wonderful. The United States goes in, it instills democracy, democracy spills over throughout the Middle East, and everybody is happy. That, I think, is to a large degree wishful thinking. We have an Iraq that has no tradition in democracy. We have a society that is divided along ethnic and sectarian lines. They are organized along clannish and tribal lines. So to suddenly instill Lockean liberalism in Iraq and for it to work the following day, I frankly do not buy that. But even assuming that it does, and again, I don't buy that, assuming that it does, having it spill over into the rest of the Middle East is also a Herculean task. And having the regimes there simply go away is yet another exercise of wishful thinking. Now, it may go in a negative fashion in that some of the regimes will entrench themselves further in order to avoid such a thing. So this business of the democratization of Iraq as a result of a U.S. campaign against it, I simply do not buy.
Not buying. And with that, we're out of time. Morhof Joujadeh, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Morhof Joujadeh is fellow at the Middle East Institute and adjunct professor of political science at George Washington University. And John Vole, joining us from Washington, thank you for being with us this hour.
My pleasure.
John Vole is professor of Islamic history at Georgetown University and associate director of the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, writer Carol Phillips on loneliness and healing. This is On Point. Writing feeds me literally and metaphorically, says award-winning author Carol Phillips. Writing provides a means by which I can sit in judgment upon myself. Born on the Caribbean island of St. Kitts and raised in Leeds, England, Phillips has set most of his novels in the UK and the West Indies. His 1993 novel, Crossing the River, follows the separate journeys from slavery to emancipation of two brothers and a sister. It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize for Fiction. This month, we've been bringing you black writers, reading from their works as part of a series put on by Harvard's W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for Afro-American Research. Tonight, Carol Phillips reads from his soon-to-be-published novel, A Distant shore. The main character of the story is a woman in her mid-50s whose longtime husband, Brian, has recently left her. In this passage, she's contemplating the affair she's having with a married Asian man named Mahmoud, an attempt to relieve her loneliness.
In bed, she knows that she satisfies. He always shudders, but he does so quickly now, and only once. These days their bodies separate with indifference, and Mahmoud is quick to give her his back. Sadly, her lover seems to have bolted down the short slope from attentive to perfunctory without any intervening stages of incremental boredom. 1 week he took the time to speak with her before, during, and most importantly, after their relations. The following week, he was racing through the motions as though he was late for an appointment. Gone were the revealing half-sentences. They call us Asians, but that doesn't mean anything, does it? Or personal tidbits that she could take as signs of intimacy. When I see my reflection in a mirror, I know that I can never go back home. Today, she bore his weight and coquettishly wrapped one leg around him as though she wished to pull him deeper. But she did not. It was all show, a gesture to prevent her from feeling as though she was merely an object speared. She does not blame Mahmoud for her present degradation, for she understands the real culprit to be Brian. She silently endured too many years of his conversation in the form of monologues about the virtues of architecturally designed patios and breakfast bars and the superiority of South African whites over French Chardonnay, conversations in which her opinions were never sought. On other days, he would simply seize a seemingly random topic and start to complain. Did she realize that you used to be able to see a specific doctor, but now everywhere is a group practice and you never know who the hell you'll be getting? Was she aware of the fact that because of the bloody unions, his bank employees were now only allowed to interface with the public from behind anger-proof glass? She quickly learned that Brian had absolutely no interest in her opinions, but by not answering back, she allowed him to look through and beyond her, until he finally convinced himself that she did not exist. When Brian walked away, she too was convinced that he was walking away from nothing, and it hurt. However, at least to begin with, Mahmoud did not treat her as though she were invisible. She stares at his back. To be desired is not unpleasant, and to be mounted and entered suggests desire. In the beginning, she toyed with the idea of asking him to find a way to stay over. She wanted him to tell his wife, Feroza, that he had to visit his brother in Leicester. But somehow she never found the courage to put this proposal before him, and he never suggested it to her of his own accord. One night she did ask Mahmoud if the next day they might go to the town museum to see a visiting exhibition of priceless Eastern miniatures, but he looked at her with disbelief writ large across his brown face. With some effort, she was able to imagine that his curdled face was rejecting the art and not her company. She smiled, but inwardly she decided that she would never again suggest anything beyond the boundaries of their arrangement. She was not a woman who coped well with rejection. But, if truth be told, Mahmoud had not rejected her. He had simply arrived at a place where he no longer felt it necessary to either woo or enchant his 55-year-old mistress.
Carol Phillips, reading from his soon-to-be-published novel, A Distant Shore. His reading came from the series Black Writers Reading, being hosted by Harvard's W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for Afro-American Research. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by